It's beer, y'all.
It's beer. I'm sitting much higher now. I feel like, serve me.
Whoa, wrong handle.
I just pulled the dump truck lever on this chair.
So we're sorry this last week that was uncomfortably weather-related. I didn't feel like driving up in snow.
Yeah.
Drenched lanes. So, and also, because of my diet, I can only do it once a week. So we were kind of screwed.
Well, yeah, I don't know if you were able to shift at all, but Super Bowl was the following day, so I don't know if you were able to take advantage of that or not.
No, because actually it's funny, because what I did is I forgot the Super Bowl was that day, but I didn't have any plans anyway. But I wanted to prepare myself and test myself for Savor. So I wanted to see what would a two-day cheat day, what effect would that have on me. Oh, okay. So I did Friday and that Saturday. And I felt more dumpy the second day, but I recovered pretty quickly.
Okay.
So it wasn't really that much of a problem. So it's definitely something I can do. It's not something I want to do often.
Right.
That's why I did it 6 months before I'd possibly need to.
Right. Gotcha.
So,
you were playing a RPG with Allison.
Yeah, I was showing Allie. These are my new dice, which I got because I want to play D&D and I want to find somebody who plays D&D, so I got myself a whole selection of dice. But, I mean, what I love about these is that what I love about using dice in general and D&D, at least the idea of playing D&D, is what we were doing with Allie, essentially playing a story and then figuring out the details of what happens in the story based on a dice roll. It allows you to craft your own thing and leave some part of it up to chance. And
the thing is, you're rolling different kinds of dice, right? But if it was like a high number, you win, you know, a low number, you lose. So you really only needed like a, you know, your four-sided dice, you know?
Well, no, I mean, because most of the time I tried to roll a 20 for most of them. And the idea is, you know, I just rolled a 14. In most cases, that's just, you know, okay, that's a success. It's nothing special, but it's a success.
Right.
If you roll like an 18 or a 19, then you do pretty great. If you hit 20, it's a nat 20, you get like double the attack. If you roll like a 9 or 10, that's you may be partially effective. And if you roll lower than that, then you may miss. And if you roll like a 1 or 2, then you hurt yourself. So there's ranges you can do with it. And it's up to the DM, it's up to the guy who is GM to decide what that is. Like, if you're trying to execute some really complicated move, then maybe you really have to get a high score in order to do a high roll in order for it to happen. If you're just trying to do something like, you know, pick your nose, then probably everything but a 1 will be effective. And, you know, a 20, you'd get double the boogers. I don't know. I just rolled a 1. Ineffective at picking my nose.
So this 24-sided die is interesting.
Yeah.
Because it's a cube but each side has 4 facets to it. But, you know, they didn't try to make it a 24-sided spherical type thing. It's, you know, it's based off, it's still a square, you know, still a cube. It's right. Interesting.
These are based off, I mean, most of these dies are based off the platonic solids. So you have your triangle, which is your 4-sided die, the tetrahedron, your cube, plain old die, but I like that it has the numbers on it instead of the dots.
You know, this is actually the kind of dice that come in, like, games for young kids, right? So they don't have to count the dots.
So we have your octahedron, your 8-sided... dodecahedrons are, this is a 12-sided. These are 10-sided die, actually. These are not platonic solids, but they are. Use 2 of them to roll, so that would be 24.
Yeah, the 10-sided die is also not what you might think, because it's like 2 halves of a diamond. There's an equator, and there's 5 sides on each side of the equator, and they're kind of a cone, 2 cones put together.
And they're 2 cones that are offset slightly.
Oh, yeah, I see that. They are offset.
With rounded edges. Then there's the icosahedron, the 20-sided. And that's your last platonic solid. And then we move on to, yeah, these weirder shapes. Like Jeff said, the 24, the 30.
Now, the 30 is a uniform shape.
It's a rhombus, each facet.
Yeah, each facet's a diamond-shaped rhombus. And they just kind of flip... go.
But like them all, I mean, I think each side, if you look at them, I think they should equal 31. Like on the 6-sided die, each side, if you add up the opposing side, it should be 7. On the 12-sided die, if you add up the opposing side, it should be 13.
Yeah, so yeah, the 30-sided is like 12 hexagons, and each hexagon's a 3-faceted face. Neat.
Yeah.
And then you get this 100-sided die, which is
just goofy.
Yeah, like Greg mentioned, like so is that like a centrahedron or a centrodecahedron or decahedron? He's like, no, it's just a circle with a bunch of divots.
Yeah.
And that's how they do it. It's a clear plastic ball, and underneath it the numbers are on the inside of the ball. And then yeah, it's a lot like a golf ball where there's just a bunch of divots.
And there's some stuff inside there that is shaped, I think they're like teardrop shaped, and it's patented actually.
Okay.
To allow it to stop, to allow it to come to a easier stop.
Oh, so it's a dampening material?
Yeah.
See, I almost thought it was in there to give you some of this, like, can't settle on a number, because it's like bouncing around a bit. But other times, it comes right to a stop, so maybe that makes sense, because you could imagine something like this with 100 sides on it would be very bouncy.
Yeah, and I don't know how often, like, a 1 or 100 will actually turn up. Jeff actually rolled a 1.
First time I rolled a 1.
Yeah. Which is, you know, it's kind of odd. But the reason why I'm not sure about how often is because they're not at the edge, because there's a sort of an equator to the ball, which I think may have an effect on it, because they're basically two sides that come together.
Uh-huh.
And at the poles are the ones in the 100. And I don't know if those are more or less favorable to come up because of their position.
Well, they drilled some holes next to the poles, right, which might offset, like, the extra mass they have compared to other parts because of the seam and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not sure what else those holes would be for.
I think, you know, but you'd have to do a 10,000 roll trial to sort of see what
put it to the test, man.
I'm not that willing. But I like.
Hey, it's from Gulfport, Mississippi, though. It's not made in China, or at least it. Maybe
the Chinese are more sensible than me.
Oh, like it does have a name. It's a.
It's a Zogby or something like that. This is the guy who made it.
Zogchinahedron.
Yeah.
Or a Zokihedron. That's
Zokihedron.
Zokihedron. Made in the USA. Look at that.
There
American
you go.
Manufacturing with tear shaped. Ballast inside.
And before I ever played D&D, I always liked these dice. I like the look and the aesthetics of them. There's something mm-hmm. just that's cool about more than just your old standard hexahedron die. But I never really had a reason to actually have them. And I decided a friend of mine, well, he's turning to a friend of mine. He's not quite that level yet. But he's turning, he says that he has a game night or a D&D that he may start up again, and that I'm welcome to come. So I was like, all right, I'll get my own dice. So, yeah, it's pretty cool. So let's see. Roll on this show. Give it a 20-sided die. Let's see how good this show will
be. This is a 20 here?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. 14.
It's not bad.
It's a C.
Could be better. That's what you're in for, guys.
Fate has spoken. We don't even have to try now. It'll just happen. It'll just come to fruition.
So, yeah. I got more story stuff if you want to go into that.
Sure.
Go okay. for it. Gonna bring out the pens and paper because I really I really like these story. A lot of papers just fell out of this.
Oh, Allie was messing around.
Yeah, it was cutting. I like the story discussion that we had last time, and I think that it was interesting to.
The movie plot thing.
Right. I was going over this for the Campbell story model, and what I wanted to bring up is sort of the reason why I love Dan Harmon so much. He took the he took that Campbell model, and also, you know, some of what Sid Field talks about in his script writing models, and what Volger talked about in that, and he sort of figured out a simpler way to an easier way to capture the story without necessarily using so much so many steps without... He sort of clarified it and moved it down, and he made it into what he calls a story circle. Now, if you just take a regular old circle and you...
This be a photograph of this on Greg's Twitter.
Probably, yeah.
We should announce it now, even though it doesn't exist yet, because they can go look it up if they want to see what
I mean, you can look up Dan Harmon's story circle. You can just, but all you have to do is take a circle and bisect it with a line, and then take those two half circles you have, and put a line from top to bottom. So you section up your circles into four, and then you draw around the circle like it's a clock. Starting at the 12 o'clock position, you put a 1. In the middle, you put a 2. At the 3 o'clock position, you put a 3. Then in the middle of that, you put a 4. At the 6 o'clock, you put a 5. In the middle of that, you put a 6. At the 9 o'clock, you put a 7. And you put an 8. There. So that's what the story circle looks like. And the point is, from Harmon's point of view, these are the 8 steps you need to have. 1, you define who you are. 2, you have a need. 3, you go to find that need. And 4 is all you're seeking that need. 5, you have found it. 6, you take it. 7, you return. 8, having changed. That's the oversimplification of it, but here's where it goes into that story model. So, like I said, the first part, most important part, is who. Introduce who this person is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to devote some time, whatever it is, to figuring out the character. So the second part is that character has to have some sort of need, or else the story's not going to go anywhere. Let's take a movie and figure out name a movie. Hopefully, well structured one.
The movie I watched last night was Silver Linings Playbook. And
okay, I don't know that one, so I can't.
But you know, it's real fresh, and you know, definitely. Well, I wasn't thinking of it. You know, remembering the stuff you told me last night, and you know, it's a romantic comedy type thing, and it definitely follows the steps we talked about last time and, mm-hmm. and also these. So, well, you know, step one is identify the character, right? So, main character is, what's his name? The dude from The Hangover.
Bradley Cooper.
Bradley Cooper is the main dude, right? And he, you know, he's in a mental institution. He's getting out to live with his parents, but his parents kind of checked him out early, right? So identifying the character. The little backstory was that he found his wife in the shower with like the tenured history teacher at the school that they taught at or something like that, right? So he had a break then, you know, diagnosed bipolar, beat the shit out of the guy. I said, okay, there's Bradley Cooper. Okay. And number two.
All right. But let's do a movie that both of us know so I can follow along all with right. you. Pick a movie that we both know.
Moon.
Okay. We meet, I don't want to do Moon because people haven't seen it.
You don't want to spoil Moon. Okay. Yeah. So what's a spoil-free movie?
Back to the Future.
Okay.
Okay. We meet Marty McFly. He is a kind of a goofy, but successful kind of high school student with weird parents and a weird relationship to them. And he also has a weird relationship with his... with his doctor friend that we don't quite understand yet.
Doctor friend.
Doc. The guy who makes the time.
Right. Yeah.
But he has a need. So after we've identified who the character is, we have to figure out what his need was. Now I'm trying to remember exactly what it was that he was seeking, but I think it was he needed the car to go to the dance with his girlfriend or something like that.
Oh, I'm having a hard time. You want to get right into the, you know, the terrorist with the plutonium. And
No. I just want to identify what part that was. Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen it.
Like, so I can't think of how he, like, you know, how Doc is even introduced in the movie.
He goes to Doc's house and there were all the clocks around, remember? And they were all, and they all went off 5 minutes late.
Yeah, I remember that scene. Yeah. Maybe we need a movie we're more familiar with, even though it's classic, right? I mean, like when you did Groundhog Day, you probably weren't familiar with it, but you kind of went back and looked over the, you know, the summary, right?
No, no, I just pulled all of those movies from memory. Okay. But I don't remember the start of Back to the Future. That's the problem. I just don't remember what it was that drove him to step three, which is go. So at step three, he gets into the car and goes. Well, I mean, you can say, well, some of the need was, well, he just saw Doc Brown get killed. The Libyans mm-hmm. are chasing after him. He needs to go. He doesn't realize that the thing is set, but who cares? He's thrown into adventure. Then step four, which was called the road of trials. So this is where he's seeking to find out what the heck's going on. So he realizes that he's been pulled into the past, and he heard about his parents meeting, and he does what he can to make sure that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets to the point where it seems like he's got that all happened. That's at point five. He has done his task, but he messes up and he gets caught. He gets in his place of his dad. He messes mm-hmm. up by saving his dad, and then he gets in the place of his dad. Or you could say, no, okay, you know what? Let me revise that. Thinking back to Back to the Future. Like we said, it's been a while. He's in four. He's kind of in the belly of the whale here. He's trying to adapt to the situation, trying to get back. Sees Doc Brown, tries to get mm-hmm. how to tell him that he needs the power to get back to the future. He sees his dad, saves his dad, and then gets hurt. Then he realizes that if he doesn't get his parents together, he's going to disappear. So step four is that part where he's trying to get his parents together.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the road of trials, the montage stuff. That's where all the, you know, the story is on how, you know, getting him together. So in step five, he manages to convince his father to, you know, using the Darth Vader thing, to to ask her out. But he's unsuccessful at it. So he gets what he wants, but she rejects him. And so we go to step six. He feels like all is lost. He can see his kids, or his siblings start to disappear, and he is forced to take his mother out and try to rape her to get his father to beat him up, not knowing that his mother is going to love it. But so it's, you know, step six is, you know, he got what he wanted, but he has to pay a price for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then so he pays the price of, you know, of having to sort of whore himself out and then get beat up by Biff and then having to play that dumb concert. But that helps him get what he ultimately wants. And he gets to return home thanks to that. And after all that, after he has finally done the stuff where he's done all the weather stuff to return mm-hmm. home, he returns home, and not only has he changed as a person, but his entire reality has changed
right.
because of what he's done. So that's the Dan Harmon sort of essence of pulling down all the steps. And what I like about this most is that there's a lot of symmetry going on here. So one is where we introduce, and five at the bottom is where he gets to the sort of the ultimate point in his journey, where what he was trying to seek. He doesn't realize at the time that it was not quite what he wanted, mm-hmm. but it's sort of a parallel of him being introduced and then him being introduced to his ultimate want. Two and six. So you have your need and you have your atonement. He has a need to make to do something, to make some sort of change, but at six, that's when him doing that change has cost him the most.
Right.
So there's a symmetry there. At three and seven, this is when you go, and this is when you return. So this is crossing the threshold into the unknown. This is returning from the unknown back to the known. You can look at the top of this as sort of order, chaos, death, life. You can that sort of anything that's sort of that's a real dichotomy you can put in there. Mm-hmm. And then 4 and 8, this is when you're seeking to get to the ultimate thing. And then 8 is when you have done the ultimate thing. So there's a symmetry there. So all the parts of the story have a symmetry mm-hmm. to them when you put them together like this. And I think that if you boil it down, every story, even the most crazy, the most ridiculous, the most weird, out-of-touch story, will follow this 1 through 8 steps.
Sure. Yep.
So there you go. That's why that... Understanding this and realizing how it fits to everything is one of the first reasons why I really glommed on Dan Harmon before Community was ever around. Because of this.
Gotcha. Speaking of Community, you want to get into that now?
Yeah.
So, well, new Community, Dan Harmonless.
Yes.
And
what is your verdict?
My verdict. I didn't put, you know, heavy thought into it until after you IM'd me, but then I was starting to think about it. And yeah, it did seem, I don't know, it seemed a little hollow, you know, it seemed a little trite, maybe. Mm-hmm. There wasn't the same kind of heart that you get.
I think that So my verdict was not terrible. That's you know.
I thought, you know, when it started, and it started out in, you know, in the sitcom, the 70s.
Right, in the four-camera sitcom.
Yeah, the 70s yeah. sitcom. You know, I thought it was pretty funny or ironic that Dan Harmon's gone and they went to the most stereotypical bad comedy thing ever, you right. know? And, you know...
No, I thought that would have been funny had they left it at that, but they kept going back to that well, and that's something that I think Dan Harmon wouldn't have done. He would have either stayed in that well and done a whole episode about mm-hmm. that and figured out how to do a whole episode around that, or he would have only gone back to that once and had different types of shows that he went to in Abed's Dreamland instead of him going deeper and deeper and then going to the babies.
The Muppet
like,
Babies.
Which is like, it was a little too far to go from... That would have been okay as a separate sort of thing, but not as a Inception double layered thing. That's mm-hmm. where it got to be too much. They spent too long on that sitcom-y, on that four camera sitcom situation. The jokes weren't quite, it didn't quite fit it. I mean, the idea, okay, the idea is kind of funny, but either you throw, if you're going to do that, then you try to put some funny jokes in there. The joke shouldn't be, ha ha, aren't those four-camera sitcom comedies lame? That's not enough of a thing to lay 5 minutes of the episode on.
Yeah. I like your idea of committing to the stereotype, but, you know, maybe putting in good jokes, mm-hmm. you know. Jokes that pander to the format, you know, expected formula type thing. You know, like... you know, when the freshman came in and Winger, you know, the sexy freshman came in and invited them to the freshman mixer, you know. Maybe that was one of the ones that joke to me was like the closest to a Community type joke, right? Where it was taking a sitcom joke, but it had some basis in the characters, you know. See, right. That seemed like one of the better, you know, jokes that you'd expect out of Community in that sitcom type genre.
And I think that's what was missing from that idea. Now, you know, let it be said that not every Community episode has been perfect. And there have been some Community episodes that have been not as good as others. And so I'm willing to give the show a chance here. I'm willing to think that they were trying too hard. But it was pretty evident that they were trying too hard here. They put 5 storylines in this thing. I don't know what the heck the story with Britta and Troy was. I don't know what the heck the story was with Annie and Shirley. The only 2 stories that mattered there were Abed's getting lost in it and Jeff trying to get.
Yeah, I mean the wishes and the popcorn yeah. in the car slash the other pranks were like,
yeah, they were just they did not belong.
The only time, you know, they would ever pull in, you know, this accidental storyline would be with, like, you know, a secondary character like Starburns or something like that, you know, where they would, you know, kind of just have a scene, you know, that was
but, you know, off. Yeah, off. I mean, those are...
And then now they're having these scenes with the primary characters, and it just seemed like...
But, like, for instance, you know, I go back... oh, look, Jamie has contacted us. So we can stop for a second, but... I go back to the story circle, and like the Troy and Bitter one, the Troy and Bitter one, they kind of got to four. That never got around to closing. You know, the other storylines got to their end. The Jeff one got to its end. The Abed one got to its end. I don't know where the Shirley and Annie one went to, but it didn't resolve itself near to the Troy and Bitter one.
Yeah, unless they're trying to, you know, stand them up with some arcs, right? But
even then, you still, yeah, in the course of, I mean, that's the thing about the reason why I love Community so much is because no matter what, even if it was a subpar episode, the story's always landed because Dan Harmon was a stickler to this.
Even the ones that were to be continued,
right?
You know,
they always landed, and that is, I think, the real reason why this season, why I feel strange, you know, I feel strangely ambivalent about this season. Well, more than just strangely, I mean, reasonably ambivalent about the season, because if Dan Harmon is not there, they're not going to land everything. Mm-hmm. And if that happens, that's not the Community that you and I love. That's a different show.
Right.
Let's get Jamie on here.
Okay.
Lunch pause and record, right, not play.
Yes, record. I believe we're going. Let's see.
Are we? Are we recording? No, it doesn't look like it.
Yes, we are. There we go. It just was all messed up.
There we are. Jamie is with us. Jamie from, is it Missouri or Missoura?
Missouri. Don't say Missouri.
Okay.
Is there a certain part of the state to call it Missouri, or is that just the country Missourians portrayed on TV?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, gotcha.
So, Jamie's one of our listeners who, actually the first one who took us up on the offer to, hey, join us on the show. And he said, yeah, sure, bring me in. And I'm sorry we couldn't have you last week, but, you know, the roads.
Hey, it's better to be safe than sorry with snow and ice like that, man. I totally understand.
Yeah, snow, ice, and beer. And
yeah, you know, those are a bad combination.
20 miles to get home, it's not always the best combination. So, yeah, you know, today's, you know, the day after... What did you call it? Obama's Snowmerica.
Yeah, Obama's Snowmerica. It just, I mean, the big storm just barely clipped us. So we got like a little bit of freezing rain for, I don't know, a couple hours, but that was it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the roads are clear today. Yeah, but last week, you know, we had a couple inches on Saturday night. So
how are you doing there in Missouri? I'm going to keep doing it because it's more fun.
it's been pretty nice, actually. We're getting ready to have some rain, but. It's been a pretty weird winter, pretty warm for winter time. So maybe the global warming thing is correct. Who knows?
Well, I think it has been unseasonably warm. I was telling Jeff recently that you know, now is February. Here's where we finally get our snow. It's going on a different schedule now than it was before. And I think that's mainly what we're going to see happen, at least in the northern hemisphere with global warming. There's more shit going down in the southern hemisphere and in the equator. That's where the real shit's going to go down.
Going to dry out.
It's going to dry out, and there's going to be severe flooding and all types of sort of bad stuff. But mostly, we're going to escape it, which is sort of why the U.S. can afford to sort of say, meh, poo-poo. Because as far as the U.S. is concerned, it's not our problem.
You know, from what I've heard, there's, you know, there's like, we're going on like a 3-year, not drought, but like farmers in the Midwest are really, the water table's really low, you know, things like
and
that.
And that's so, going to happen. The areas of farming are going to change in this country.
Yeah.
But we have enough wealth to be okay as a society. Some people are going to go bankrupt. Some farms are not going to be farmland anymore. And some places that weren't are going to be.
So I sent you a quick message the other day about the Iranian space monkey.
Yeah, Jamie, did you see this story?
I glanced over it. I didn't really pay much attention to it, unfortunately.
So the one thing, you know, I you know, heard about the space monkey. I read a really brief article about it, but I didn't look too closely. And then on The Daily Show, they showed that the before and after pictures of the space monkey were clearly two different monkeys. Yeah. So it seemed as though, you know, oh, monkey one's gone, let's get monkey two. But you said that there might be a more legitimate reason.
There was a story I read on a place where, I think it was Ars Technica where I read it, where they, it was firmly established that the Iranians did launch something into space. That much is for sure. And it was there for a while, you know, for however long they said it was and came down. Now, we don't know that whether that was a monkey or not, but it, you know, it definitely they got something into space and retrieved it. That much is established. And there is also, I guess, the Iranian press, you know, they don't usually say we get something wrong, even when it's totally obvious. But they did say, yeah, we messed up. We sent out a picture of the wrong monkey. So it is conceivably possible that they sent out, because they had a mission like this before with a different monkey that they sent up and did not go well. It is conceivable that they kind of messed up and sent up gave out the wrong monkey picture. But it was clearly a different monkey. But that story was not nearly as funny as the other Iranian story.
Yeah, Greg showed me this one. It was also on Ars Technica about the Iranian stealth fighter.
Yes.
And you need to go, Jamie, right now, go find the pictures of the Iranian stealth fighter. They were claiming this to be the real flight-worthy airplane. And if you just go through the slideshow and read the captions, I mean, it just becomes more and more clear. They start off with subtle things like, oh, the finish of the skin, you know, is shiny and radar, you know, absorbent material can't be shiny. You know, shiny means stuff's bouncing back. Light is bouncing back to your eyes, right? And then they go further and further about, look at the size of the plane compared to the pilot that's sitting in it. It's tiny. And then they go even further. Like, they show you the avionics, and all the avionics are from, like, Cessnas and commercial small craft. And, like, the cowling's not even on the back. The wires are sticking out. And then, oh, look at the side of the cockpit. It's body fiberglass. Of the airplane is fiberglass, and it's just a single layer of fiberglass.
Yeah, I'm looking at pictures right now. That looks pretty hokey to me.
And then, like, the engine was covered up, and the intakes were covered up, but there was no nozzle.
Right.
So, like, that's the one of the things, you know, because I looked through all the pictures without reading the captions first to see what I could pick out. And, you know, it was almost personally embarrassing that I thought it looked more legit than it did after I read the captions. Uh-huh. But one of the things I did pick out was I saw the fiberglass body, and I'm like, there's no jet nozzle. You know, there's no engine nozzle. Yeah. Like, it's just going to catch on fire. But, you know, once they point out, look at the pilot in there, and look at the size of the airplane compared to it. And then they show a picture of, like, a, you know, an F-16 or something, you know, and it's huge. It's like four times as big. Yeah.
I mean, these planes are ridiculously huge. I mean, the cockpits on them are small, but it's not like one of those toys where you get, you know, it's not like one of those horsey toys, which is what this thing was.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
We're monopolizing the conversation. Jamie, you're our guest. Do you have anything to talk about?
Well, Greg, I wanted to point out, so you had seen the largest known prime number was discovered this week.
Yes, it's a Mersenne prime.
Yep.
I think it's called GIMPS.
Yeah.
The Great Internet Mersenne Prime Search.
Oh, is that what found it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's
and actually the guy who found it is one of my old math professors at my alma mater, so it was kind of cool to see that it was him.
Wow, that's
so
cool.
It was kind of crazy.
I'd always thought about getting that down and putting it on my computer for, you know, for the idle cycles, just for the hell of it. He got $3,000 for it. So just for letting the thing run on his computer.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's 2 to like to the 500,000th power or something. It's ridiculous.
17 million characters.
Yeah, numbers. Yeah, 17 million digits long, and it ends with a 1. Yeah, prime numbers could only end with after the first 3. Prime numbers can only end with 1, 3, 7, or 9. So. Yeah, it's the largest known prime number. It's also the 48th Mersenne prime, which is 2 to the x minus 1. So it's 2 to the 580-something thousand minus 1. And it also gives us a perfect number, because the cool thing about Mersenne primes is that there's a formula for making a Mersenne, making a perfect number out of it, which is 2 to that prime number times 2 to... Or 2 to that number minus 1 times 2 to that number is equal to a perfect number. So it's some ridiculously huge number.
Okay.
But the really cool thing about the GIMPs is, and I don't really know how it works.
So wait, did you say double this number minus 1 is also prime?
No. Okay. 2 to this factor minus 1 times 2 to that factor. Plus 1. I think something like that. I forget. Is it that, or is it 2 to that factor plus 1?
It's so, yeah, 2 to the factor minus 1, and then I forget what the other is that you actually get to it, but
yeah.
I'm trying to read through it right now. But it's like 2 to the 57 millionth 885,000 161 minus 1. It's crazy. So it has a file size of 22.45 megabits alone. So
yeah. Now the thing is that you can't. This is an NP hard problem. You can't just solve it by factorizing that. That's way too much. You can't just go through and get half of that and then just keep lowering the numbers and see if any of the things factorize it. There's more. You know, that would take. God, that would take. Millions of years, if not more. So there's some procedural way of doing it that I don't understand how they do it, but it's math. Math is crazy like that.
Math's not my forte, so.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I wasn't the student. I mean, math and science were my better subjects, but to get into like crazy math just was not for me.
I'm trying to get into it more, and it's. You know, it reaches a point where it does get really hard is not the right word, but it's just you have to change your mode of thinking, and it's really hard to do that. Doing a calculation is relatively easy. You simply put down what you need to calculate. You know how to do all that calculation. And there you go. But thinking in a different way in order to get to the answer to the problem, that's where the hard stuff comes in.
I think it maybe interested me. I'd be interested, but like algebra, I never really.
Oh, algebra! I love algebra, but you use algebra every day.
But maybe it was my professor, because I didn't do well. But then I went and took physics for fun during the summer semester, and I aced it. I got an A. So there you go, because I wanted to learn it. So
yeah, I don't know. That's always the problem, and wanting to learn is not just a factor of you, it's also a factor of who your teacher is, right? So if you have a really good teacher, he's going to make you want to learn. Or she is going to make you interested in that topic.
Yep. Physics was definitely fun. Had a good instructor, so. He even took a day out when he wasn't supposed to and tried to explain string theory to us.
did you tell him? You didn't know me at the time. Did you tell him Greg says string theory is bullshit?
Well, he said it all based on if it was all just a theory, so we'd have to find, whatever, if it happens. But, you know, it's if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, then we move on and try to figure out the universal equation some way else. So, I don't know.
Oh, I'll rail against string theory again. Isn't string theory a theory? It ruins the good name of theory because it's a conjecture.
Just like evolution.
Exactly, yeah. It ruins evolution because evolution is a theory. Or I should say this, evolution is a fact. Natural selection is a theory. The fact that things change is a fact, and that's all evolution is. But the mechanism, natural selection, is the theory. And the difference between fact and theory is fact is just a numerical thing. Fact is just like, so you can say like the law of gravity. Well, that's just a numerical thing. And that's all it is. It doesn't explain anything. But the theory of gravity explains why there's gravity. So evolution does something. Well, that just, evolution means change over time. It's just a definition of a word. So to say it's a fact is very silly. Things change over time. That's,
oh yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with the fact that it's still just a theory. I mean, that's what I wish people would get through their heads, that.
But, you know, the theory of evolution is how it works. And how it works is our complete knowledge of how the system works. And so, yeah, it's a theory, but it's a theory like the theory of gravity or the germ theory of disease, or, you know, these are actual, we have done lengthy studies on this. This is our absolute best, most solid interpretation of all the evidence, and nothing has come up that has made these theories look wrong in any way. Everything has confirmed these theories and just added strength to these theories. So where string theory fails is that there's no test. There's no experimental evidence for it whatsoever. The reason why I wouldn't even consider it a hypothesis, because at least if you have a hypothesis and you have an experiment in mind, maybe you can't do it yet, but you can imagine one. But there isn't one that people can imagine that would absolutely say string theory yes or string theory no. There are ones that people say, well, you may get a null answer for this, but that doesn't mean string theory is dead. Well, if you do that, then that's not a test of string theory. So
here's a question. You know, I mean, string theory is what it is because there's some math that works, or kind of works, right?
Right.
It's interesting math. It's plausible.
It builds on probably the most important part of 20th century physics, which is symmetries. And it builds off of symmetries in nature and symmetries in the mathematics, and keeps finding interesting ones.
Right. So, you know, I'm trying to think, I don't have an example off the top of my head, but, you know, trying to think of things in the past where, you know, it was interesting because the math worked out, right? Even though there was no test, but maybe there was still hypothesis, right? Because,
right,
you know, like Einstein, right? There wasn't necessarily the technology to test speed of light, relativity, things like that, right? Mm-hmm. But he at least had tests, right? He had hypotheses.
Yeah, yeah. It was the, you know, hypothesis of special relativity. But he, you know, there was a test right away. You know, this eclipse is going to happen. See if it bends light. Well, that was more general relativity. Mm-hmm. Well, special relativity.
Well, I mean, my point is, you know, you said there's no test for string theory.
Yeah.
You know, I'm trying to think, you know, is there something that's been legitimized where at the moment that it was cutting edge, it was just math and there was no test, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, that would be, relativity would be a good example of that. The neutrino, when Dirac proposed the, I think it was Dirac who proposed the neutrino. Pauli.
Wasn't Neutra? Wasn't Neutra?
Well, he called it a neutron, actually. But that was before they actually discovered there were neutral particles that they then named neutrons. But the reason why is because there was this bit of, they're doing these interactions, and there's a symmetry to interactions where one side goes in, one side goes out, the energy should stay the same. And there was a bit of energy they were losing, and they weren't sure why. And so Pauli sent a letter and said, well, you know, maybe it's this little thing that we can't detect because it's neutral. And I'll call it the... and eventually got called the neutrino. And ultimately, that showed up. The Higgs boson is another example. There's this math that shows that maybe there's this nature kind of works like there's a superconducting field, and perhaps that's why certain things gain mass and don't. And we just recently found, okay, there is some field there, and we can get a piece of it. Maybe that it, and we assume that it's the Higgs field. We haven't proven that yet, but mm-hmm. There's no reason to assume it's not, really.
Talking about math things a little bit, I was listening to a Security Now podcast last week about memory hard problems. Memory hard is like AES encryption, you know, it uses, you know, hashing algorithms and whatnot to do the encryption. And it isn't future-proof, right? Because the faster equipment gets, the faster it can. It can be paralyzed. Like, there's people that run Bitcoin farms, right, where they have 100 PS3s in their living room, and they've programmed the GPUs to just do algorithm hashing, right? And they paralyze them, and they pipeline them. So, like, every cycle they're going through, you know, getting, a, you know, even, you know, getting these hashes where the trying to get the some of the make sure I don't miss the details here, but memory hard would be instead of like so to you know most sites to protect your password they'll do a key password based key derivation function where they'll hash your password like 1,000 times 2,000 mm-hmm. times, and the idea is, you know, when you're storing the password, you hash it 2,000 times, no big deal. It takes a little bit of effort on your computer, but not a lot. If someone's trying to brute force that password, you know, every attempt they do, they have to hash it 2,000 times. And, you know, when you're trying to do 10 million attempts to brute force something times 2,000, it adds up. It adds a delay to that. However, it's not future-proof because they're talking about how in a pipeline you could have a bunch of FGPBAs strung together and you could have each one doing the next hash. So say you have 2,000 CPUs in a line, right? You could have, you start putting them in the pipeline and it'll take 2,000 cycles for your first answer to come out. But after that, every cycle you get an answer to come out, right? You know, so,
right.
And you could just scale this thing so it could, you know, this kind of, the key derivation is not future-proof, but memory hard is a kind of thing where to do your password hash, and I don't have all the details on how they do this, but it actually, say, it requires to write out 4 gigs of RAM.
Huh.
And then it does something where it does some kind of checksum against the RAM, and then it gives you your to really make it simple, it gives you your hash, right? Your secure hash. It can't be sped up. You can't parallelize it. You need a lot of RAM to do this. You know,
I don't know why hashing. You couldn't just in the future get a bunch of virtual machines if you had a bunch of a bunch more RAM that was more memory dense and make the virtual machines.
But that's the thing. RAM takes space, and it's not like transistors on. From what they said, it's not like transistors on silicon. The RAM is not going to, RAM takes more space, and it's not going to get an order of magnitude smaller in the future.
But you could feasibly find a way to trick the computer into thinking that it has RAM.
When no, the way this thing is implemented. You could. But it would take so much. It would take so much CPU.
Did you catch that, Jamie?
Well, no. It just came back to me. Let me see if I'm finding the notes here. Because you don't know what pointers you're going to need to have in memory. Because
mm-hmm.
You can't tell what all the pointers you're going to need in memory. So you would have to calculate the whole 4 gigs of RAM and then just save just that pointer. So it would actually be okay. So it would be more work, but could that be parallelized? You'd have to listen to the show to get that answer. I don't remember all the details.
I mean, it sounds to me, I don't have all the details, but it sounds to me like you could string together a bunch of virtual machines. It's still not future-proof. It's just, it'll take longer for it to get to that point. It's near future-proof, but it's not far future-proof.
But I'm going to see if I can find the thing about why you can't.
What that reminds me of is I was just listening to a lecture by Lawrence Krauss, and he was talking about the end of the universe. But as an aside, because he was at a conference in Melbourne that was talking about the singularity. And for those unfamiliar, I don't know, Jamie, are you familiar with the singularity?
A little bit. I still need to read Kurzweil's book on the singularity is coming, but.
Yeah, the idea being that we'll see some sort of new kind of renaissance when computing power gets big enough, and people are not quite sure what exactly that means. Does it mean that we merge with our machines? Does it mean that we use the universe itself as a calculation tool? It's a weird thing. But what What Krauss demonstrated is that we can tell from physics that there's a limit to Moore's law. There's actually a fundamental limit at which point Moore's law has to stop. So Moore's law is a doubling of computing power every 12 months, roughly. But every time you double your power, your computing power, in order to do those operations, that takes energy. So you can calculate how much energy that would take, and you can then calculate what's the most amount of energy we can possibly, as a civilization, we can get. And, you know, the only way you can get any information, or the way you can get the most possible information is if you were to turn everything in from that's mass directly into energy in an expanding sphere that expands out at light speed. Right, so that's if you got all the energy of space and time in an expanding sphere that expands out at light speed, that's the fastest that the universe would allow you to possibly collect energy. And it's something like 10, you'd get after, you know, like 4 years, 10 to the 67 joules or something, some ridiculous energy. But the point is that at about 400 years of doubling with Moore's law, that is more information than you can possibly get by taking all the mass and energy of the universe and turn that directly into energy to derive into your computing mechanism. So this is a physical limit to Moore's law. I kind of like that there is that you could derive that. What do you think, Jeff? Jeff is still...
Yeah, no, I was listening. Yeah, I mean, the physical limit to Moore's law, you know, that's where you get into parallelization, right? Interconnect, right? Because maybe I missed some of the nuance of what you were saying, but I'm sorry. I wanted to get the answer about why you can't, why you can't cheat on memory hard problems. And I got some of the information here.
Well, the point is that even to parallelization or whatever, mm-hmm. there's a limit to computational power, period. Because computational power, no matter what, requires energy. And there's a limit to how much energy you can extract from the universe.
Okay, right. But if we're running up against that wall.
But the thing is that wall is if you take the maximum amount of energy we could possibly extract using any unknown method, which is take the energy of something, turn it directly into energy with no waste, a sphere expanding at the speed of light, because you can't have anything go faster than the speed of light in order to.
Right.
Derive the energy. So a sphere expanding at the speed of light, turn everything that's there directly into energy without any loss, and pump that into computers. At the rate of Moore's law is going, even if we were able to extract energy with that kind of efficiency, which is the physical limit that the universe puts on getting information, on getting energy, Moore's law will stop at 400 years. The amount of power it would take to power computing devices that have that do that much cycling power, it's too much energy.
So even if energy was 100% efficient and the computation was 100% efficient, you just couldn't get
past a certain point.
Big enough power cables.
Yeah,
that's weird.
that's what I love about physics.
400 years, huh?
Yeah. It actually turned out to be 250 years because you can only get a certain, because the sphere is only expanding at light speed, so you can only get a certain amount. Mm-hmm. if you do Lawrence Krauss symmetry lecture, it's near the end of the lecture.
Okay.
Lawrence Krauss singularity lecture. It's at the end of that lecture, but it's really fascinating and really cool. Well,
all right. Yeah. So with this, I'm sorry. So I was just trying to recap here. What they're talking about is, algorithms can be hashed faster and things like that. So more CPU power. You know, find new ways to hash, like the Bitcoin farms. You know, they're obsoleted every month because someone finds a faster way to hash AES. So you could farm Bitcoins faster with the new, FGPA or something like that, as opposed to the old style, Bitcoin farms. So talking here. If you were trying to run a memory hard problem through a processor, sure, you can. You can do that, but it adds like 20,000 times, burden to doing it versus doing it, with memory.
But that doesn't make it a future. Or that doesn't make it a future-proof problem.
Sure. Okay.
It makes the future hard.
Yeah.
This is where I get into, you know, Jeff and I had the conversation, and I talked about it a bit on Twitter about NP, you know, the P versus NP problem. If, you know, if P equals NP, then it's off or not anyway. And the question is there a way that P equals NP? And my stance is that P probably does not equal NP for top-down problems, but I'm not sure about bottom-up solutions to problems. Emergent solutions, like the thing I was showing Jeff, which was the ants. The way that ants can are really dumb individually, but a bunch of ants can get together, even though they're really, really dumb, and they can move something from one thing to another, to another place extremely efficiently, more efficiently than if you were to program them to all be very, very smart. And it's because an emergent solution develops, it actually mm-hmm. solves the problem quicker. And so the question is, if you could build up algorithms to do it from the bottom up, really dumb, but an emergent solution would appear, could you do something much more efficient?
See, I didn't read the paper, but, you know, from my knowledge of emergent solutions, you know, efficiency does arrive
at
a certain point, right? But, I mean, it's really, it's a random search / brute force method, right? I mean, you know, ants find a food source by accident.
Yes.
Right? And then it slowly becomes, priority slowly gets turned up as by accident a second ant follows the first ant's trail. And you know, but, you know, the second ant, it's almost random chance that he's going to follow that first ant's trail versus any other ant's trail, right? So, you know, and then after that, there's starting to be a little more pressure to follow that trail. But, you know, it's this by accident thing. And you know, Greg was mentioning, you know, could computing, you know, be solved this way? Or he like asked, you know, the industry I'm in, can storage be solved this way?
Especially the reason why I ask is because I know you're dealing with extremely large volumes of storage, and you're trying to manage extremely large solutions quickly. And so my question was, is there a way that you can do that with really dumb objects that swarm?
Well, right. I mean, so my initial thought was, I could see
By the way, Jamie, I'm sorry if we're kind of overwhelming the conversation.
It's you know, my thought was, you know, if you're doing research, right, if you're doing simulation, you know, I could see the compute side of the you know, the experiment, you know, doing these kinds of things, right? You know, seeing what comes up. That's what simulations often do, right? It's going to take a researcher with a much bigger brain than me to figure out how storage can work that way, because you don't want to lose your storage. And, you know, it's perfectly conceivable an ant colony will lose the best food source ever, right? Because
yeah, in fact, there's ways you can trick the ant colony. Like there are ways that the ants can fall into, I forget what it's called, but you can actually get it where ants start going into a circle, and it's sort of a death circle. Mm-hmm. That they just keep, because they put down a path, but the path that leads them back to their hive gets lost, and so you just get a swarm of ants that go into a big circle.
It's at a certain cadence that, you know, doesn't let it time out or anything like that. Because right. You know, like an ant trail, they actually have, like, you know, the pheromones evaporate and they time out if they're not in use. And I could definitely see how you could trick them into an ant circle. So I mean, that's the that'd be the problem with storage, because not many places want to access their storage at happenstance, you know? You kind of need to know where it's at.
Here's a video of an ant circle doing just that.
Oh, it's a hurricane.
Yeah.
It's a hurricane of ants. That is so awesome. Oh, he's going to try to show Jamie. is it pointing in the right way, Jamie?
Yeah.
So, you got two laptops pointing at each other.
Yeah. So, I mean, these things can be gamed.
Hurricane of ants. That's hurricane pretty cool.
And they're just, you know, so it works great, but occasionally it works really, really poorly. And it works poorly enough times that this is a known phenomenon. So,
well, so again, the whole, it's not just the emergent properties of one colony, it's the development of the entire species, right? One colony can get into an ant hurricane and kill themselves, but species, you know, the DNA part, right? The really, you know, the real thing there, you know, it's diversified. It didn't put all their eggs into one colony. So.
Right, right. So, Jamie, we haven't heard much from you. We're sorry. We're
on a roll.
Yeah.
Hey, it's cool. I just enjoy listening. It gives me some stuff to write down and check into. So,
do you have anything you want to chat about, even if it's completely off tangent from what we've been discussing, math and memory hard and ants and emergence?
No, did you guys see the new Spieglau Sierra Nevada Dogfish Head IPA glass they put together?
I did see the Bell's Too Hearted new pint glass, which looks really cool. But it's just a pint glass. But I still want one because it looks really cool. But no, a Spieglau IPA glass. That sounds cool. What does it look like?
Yeah, supposedly Sam was pretty not going to believe, not a non-believer, until they actually got it built. And he got one, and he said when he started, it was just like a shooting a rocket of hops right in your face when you really took a whiff of it. So he went from non-believer to evangelist pretty quick from what he said on this video I saw.
I was recently at the beer store and surprised the hell out of me to see a Sam Adam 12-pack that's all IPAs, various different IPAs they have now. Because it tries out on me because we've talked to Jim, and Jim has said, we don't find IPAs that interesting. Well, they
looks
find
kind of like
now.
Ribbed condom, doesn't it?
Like it looks kind of like it belongs in last week's post show.
it's similar to the Sam Adams glass, but a little bit different on top.
I don't know. It looks mostly like it's mostly like these tulip glasses, which I'll show you. These, you know, these things. It's not quite a tulip. It's a little more tapered off at the top, but then it's got more of a handle at the bottom. I guess that maybe may help it warm up some. But I don't know. It doesn't look to me like it's going to be that more effective at giving an IPA than these.
Well, then these is one thing, right? But you know, there is a. You know, I seem to think there's a real difference between using these good glasses and using, you know, even like I got some, you know, like some of my old favorites were my Unibrew Maudit snifters. You know, they were a big, bold snifter, but they're the thick, heavy glass. And I'm convert to the Spieglau.
Yeah, it's true. We can't recommend these Spieglaus enough.
I just tweeted you guys the YouTube video with Ken and Sam talking about the new glass, so if you want to view that, you can.
Okay.
Cool.
It's actually on this article here that I found, too. I'll have to check that out. Thanks for the heads up. I had missed this one.
No problem at all.
But, of course, they're going to talk, you know, highly about their $25 beer glass. Or $25 for a pair, so.
Well, you know, maybe we could ask.
Oh, sure.
We have one of each because one has the Sierra Nevada logo etched in it, and the other one has the dogfish head. So you have to spend $50 to get both of them to get the set.
Sneaky. See, I just said recently where, you know, I think the people that pay $20 for a pair of glasses, $25 for a pair of glasses, probably want ones without logos on them, but maybe that's just my opinion, you know.
I'm with you because, yeah, I mean, if you're going to get a glass like this, I mean, pint glasses are, you know, $2 a dozen, right? Mm-hmm. So getting one with a logo on it is fine. But if you're going to spend money for a glass like this, you're not going to use it on just one thing. It's like, you know, if you get a good wine glass, you're not going to use it on just one brand of wine. Why should the same thing apply to
beer? Also, you know, showing your, you know, it's like wearing your team jersey, you know? So it's kind of like that, too. So, I mean, there's...
But I don't know many craft beer fans who are like that. I don't know craft beer fans who are brand loyal.
Well, craft loyal, right? You know, but you have a lot of teams. You have, like, you know, I still have a bunch of logo glasses, right? You know.
Well, yeah, but like I said, they're a dime a dozen. That's why.
Sure. But, you know, there's glasses where I either like the brewery or I like the design more, and I've kept those over, you know, because I've given away, you know, plenty of glasses. So, you know, it's nice having those on the shelf. So, I mean, I can't say that, you know, you're stupid for buying a Dogfish Head Spieglau glass.
Well, I don't think it would be suggesting, you know, they're stupid.
Yeah, but, you know, me personally, you know, if I was dropping the money, I would want just elegant
simplicity
beer glass.
Yeah.
Well, I got lucky and I went to, I don't know if you guys have reclaimed freight outlets up there.
No.
Okay, there, basically, we have.
You know what there is? There's a place in Harrisburg where you can go to, and all the stuff that they confiscate from people going on the planes.
Okay.
Is goes to this one warehouse in Harrisburg, and you can buy stuff like super cheap.
Huh. Okay, this like is stuff that's like cosmetically damaged or broken, and they'll sell it back really cheap.
Okay.
Well, I went there before Christmas, and I found the 4 set of Spieglau for $9. But the only thing was the stem was broken on the tulip. So, but I still got 3 for $9. I really couldn't complain that much.
Was it the like the one of each pack? Is that
yeah?
The one? Okay.
Yeah, I got the. Heffy, the tall pills, and the lager.
I got two of the tulips with stems broken off, and someday I'm going to make like a really cool like handle or holder for it, right? Like this bony hand or something like that. So we'll have these very gothic.
Yeah, but apparently two of these just broke really easily, right?
Well, yeah, the stem broke off the one. I had it, and I just bumped another glass into it. I'm so scared to do it now, just to... really casual little bump, and it just snapped right off the stem. And yeah, so two with broken stems, and then I think I actually I broke two other glasses. I had a really bad run with the Spieglau glasses for about a month,
like the
December,
only two we have left,
like
right?
In December. Yeah, I broke four of them, so yeah, it made me sad. But we these are the two good ones that we have left, and then we got some of the Savor ones, which they're just as nice. Glass are just not as big. They don't have as much of a
right.
You know,
and
bowl
and
to
they're
catch
a little
the aroma.
Thicker. I think they're a little thicker, just a little bit.
I think the ones that are more like white wine glasses, those are probably a little thicker.
Yeah.
The ones that are a little more sniftery, I think that I'm pretty good with those. But then they have they have an etching on it. They're not the clear mm-hmm. simple elegance that I like. So
yeah. But if you're going to buy a Spieglau glass, which we recommend you do it through our website. So,
craftbeerradio.com/Amazon.
So we make, if you spend, I don't know, what is it, for how much, for what it is, $24 or something?
Yeah.
We'll make
4-6%.
Yeah, so less than a dollar.
Yeah.
Way less than a dollar. But.
You buy a case of them. Now we're talking.
Yeah. I've spent a good couple hundreds through Amazon already. And that is translated to less than $30.
we had some good take up last week from promoting it, so we'll just have to keep that up. And
it's all me. Every single one of those was me.
No, there was that. There was that ice ball mold. Wasn't
okay,
you?
Okay, that's not me.
And there was the Spanish book, and,
right?
And a few other things.
All the ones I looked at, besides those, were me. That's me. That's me. That's me. That's me. That's me.
So what's the avocado oil for?
It's a cooking oil.
Cooking oil, okay.
It's a it holds up well to high temperature, and it's doesn't have trans fats.
Oh, interesting.
That and macadamia oil are really good cooking oils.
Okay. I was wondering if it was a supplement or something, or,
nope.
Or if it's just cooking oil. Because I had never heard of avocado oil. Like, sounds tasty, but does it have any essence of avocado to it?
A little bit. It's cool. Good for salads too.
Okay.
Better than olive oil, I think.
Very cool. Well, you want to go drink some beer?
Yeah.
Jamie, anything else you want to discuss before we let you go?
Not unless you want me to kick some evil twin science on you real quick.
Yeah,
but.
Bring it up.
Oh, yeah, evil twin. We got to mention that in the show because, we talked about the cowboy in the last show that we recorded, right? We didn't know too much about evil twin.
Yeah. That's right. You were one of the ones who told us about it. So, Jamie, go ahead.
Yeah. There's another podcast I listen to. I don't mean to,
Go ahead.
Please, there are lots of podcasts out there. We don't want you to only listen to us. That's for sure.
But they had Yeppie, who's the main guy, and he's from Denmark, and basically he just started brewing in different places, being the gypsy brewer, even though he doesn't really like that term. But he wasn't the one who made it up. So, but he does stuff in Copenhagen, but it was kind of expensive to do stuff there because. The brewery is on an island, so they had to import all the malt and everything, all the ingredients. So it was really pricey.
Okay.
So he said he was moving to New York, and I guess he'd contract brews out of New York and North Carolina right now, but he's working with some new brew that's coming up that's going to be opening in Connecticut that is going to really help them out by brewing a lot of beer there. And he says he likes it because he can do a lot of different stuff. And if he makes screws up something, then he's like, oh, well, we tried. But
yeah, he's like how much the smoke they put in the cowboy.
Yeah. But so by Jesse Brewer, he just goes around different breweries and makes stuff. And they sort of like, hey, you're, you know, we know you're good. Here, use this piece of equipment.
There's that. I mean, Pretty Things is another Gypsy brewer. Dan Paquette, I think is his last name, up in the Boston area. And, it's not just, typically he has to brew in the middle of the night, you know, third shift type thing when he can get access to the brew house. But also he has to find breweries that have spare fermentation capacity.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And most breweries don't have spare fermentation capacity, right? That's a bottleneck for a lot of breweries. So, you know, that's probably the hardest part of being a gypsy brewer is finding a place, get the relationship so they trust you to use their stuff, and then also find a place that has, you know, room for you to put your beer into ferment.
And did you guys really think the cowboy was that smoky?
It was pretty smoky.
The interesting thing, he said that they only used 10% of the malt bill was a smoked malt for that beer.
It was enough.
So I thought it was kind of interesting.
It was enough. I mean, it was extremely smoky. So the fact that he uses only 10% just, you know, shows you, I think, you know, how smoky it is. Because if 10% is really shining through, then it has to be really smoky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty crazy. I'll see if I can find one around here somewhere.
It reminds me of the story you told me about the, Jeff, about the Ring of Fire, which is that,
okay,
you know, they made Ring of Fire, and they had, all the, you know, a couple barrels of Tabasco with it, and they put like 2 or 3% of that with the regular porter, because otherwise it'd be ridiculously hot.
Yeah, this was Iron Hill Brewery out in eastern Pennsylvania. They did a Tabasco barrel aged porter.
I remember you guys talking about that.
Yeah. And the Tabasco barrels made the beer so hot that they, you know, one barrel blended out to you know, yeah, 50, 100 barrels of beer type thing. So probably even more than 50.
Crazy. Yeah. But they nailed it. They absolutely nailed it.
Yeah.
I would say that Evil Twin did not nail it with the cowboy. But that was.
Are you guys familiar with Stillwater?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we try to think. No, we can't.
I know it rings a bell.
Yeah, they're from Georgia, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or, well,
am I thinking of
Brian Strumke, the guy that runs? He's another one of the guys that jumps around breweries and does gypsy brewing, whatever you want to call it. Him and Yeppy have another phantom brewery together called Perfect Crime. So something else.
Oh, Stillwater. See, that's why I was hesitant, because I knew I confused them in the past. There's Sweetwater and Stillwater. So Sweetwater is the one in Georgia, right? The one that does the...
Wasn't Stillwater also the name of the band in Almost Famous?
I have no idea.
I don't either.
Yeah, so Sweetwater is the Atlanta Brewing, and then Stillwater, where are they from?
Well, I think he's from the East. Maybe I know he set up a new... brew pub
New York
in Boston,
or something,
I
right? I think it's Baltimore. Oh, that's right. They're in Baltimore. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, but yeah, when I first, I wonder how long I heard, you know, I heard someone talking about Stillwater and thought they were talking about Sweetwater. You know, I just wasn't paying close enough attention.
Yeah.
Okay. Very cool.
So yeah, but also Yuppie is the twin brother of Meckle from Meckler Beers. So if you've ever had the Beer Geek breakfast or Beer Geek brunch, that's his brother. So
yep,
there you go.
It's a crazy family there.
Yeah, very much so.
Making some very interesting beers all around.
Huh. Cool.
All right, so I do think we need to.
Yes, we need to get onto our show. Thanks for joining us, Jamie. And
hey, thanks for having me, guys. You guys take it easy and then drink some good beers.
All right. Talk to you
later. That's our plan.
All right. We'll talk to you later.
See ya.
Bye.